with Coach Butch McAdams. Welcome to another edition of In and Out of Sports in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams. This show is sponsored in part by Horton's Funeral Service, Dr. Edward T. Buford, the Athletic Republic Capital Region, and it is powered by our great friends at the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com. And this show is produced by simply the best. He is Rick Hampton Sr. Well, folks, we have another legend in the Coach's Corner. So without further ado, we're going to bring him on. And I'm telling you, this guy is a legend. You can make the argument he is the greatest high school basketball coach of all time. He's got national title banners hanging on the wall in Dunbar. That's Dunbar, Baltimore. He is the legendary, the great Bob Wade. Coach Wade, good evening, and it is an honor, as always, talking sports with you.
Good evening, Butch. It's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Well, Coach, you, through the years, you've been a mentor, a model, and an influence for so many students and student-athletes. But take us back to a young Bob Wade in Baltimore City. Who were some of the mentors and role models for you growing up?
Wow. See, growing up in Baltimore was not an easy task. I was from a single-parent home. My father deserted my mother when I was 4 years of age, my sister and I. And so I was raised by a single parent. And, of course, I sort of gravitated to local rec centers. You know, I looked up to a lot of the rec leaders, my pastor. And, of course, I'm very fortunate enough to have grown up and attended Dunbar High School in Baltimore under the leadership of Bill Sugar Cane. Mr. Cane was my idol. You know, the guy that I really looked up to. He was my father figure. So those couple of the folks that I looked up to growing up in Baltimore. But it's very difficult because that father figure was not in the home. And I depended on, you know, a lot of outside folks to be that father figure.
And back then, growing up in the era of the late 50s and, of course, the 60s, talk about the playground being the sanctuary where you could go and play sports, whether it was basketball or football or go to the swimming pool. And once you step between those white lines, all things equaled out.
Well, that's true, Butch. You know, the playground was sort of your haven. You know, you would go there and interact with the other kids in the neighborhood, and you kind of got your rep. You know, doing great things on the field or the playground, and you know, you just try to work hard at your craft, develop your craft on the playground, and you got that notoriety and respect from your peer group. So, the playground was my sanctuary. It really was.
And let's go back and talk about a guy who I think I can say, and I don't know the history of Baltimore City basketball as well as you and Cleve and Clayton and Leonard Ham, just to name a few, you know, Douglas. But from my recollect, from where I stand, if you're talking about a godfather of basketball, it has to be Sugar Cane.
No question. Mr. Cane sort of, he laid the blueprint for high school basketball in Baltimore, especially in the inner city. You know, Mr. Cane was from Washington, D.C., and gravitated over to Baltimore, and he really started the pipeline. You know, he was a Pied Piper. Mm-hmm. He did great things. He organized guys from the inner city, made them a very competitive basketball team, and they had to travel outside of Baltimore to play. They could not, you know, we're talking about Clay Brister and that group. They could not play against the local schools in Baltimore. They had to find games, or Mr. Kane had to find games in Annapolis, in Washington, D.C., against, you know, Cardoza in Annapolis. What's it, Bates High School?
Yeah, Bates High.
So Mr. Kane really, he laid the foundation for Bob Wade to come along. He really did.
Now, Coach, you know, you mentioned Clee Brister, our great friend, the godfather. We love him. And tremendous athlete in his own right. He may be listening. And I don't want him to have nightmares when you talk about him traveling to D.C. because he may not sleep well, because he may see a big a big picture of Elgin Baylor dunking on him.
Oh, boy. That's a good one, Butch.
Mm-hmm. What made Sugar Cane so special? I mean, every coach, a Bob Wade, a Morgan Wooten, a John Thompson, they have qualities that go beyond the X's and O's. What made Sugar Cane special?
Mr. Cane was a no-nonsense person. You know, he expected you to go to class. He expected you to do what you were supposed to do, you know, as far as, you know, schoolwork was concerned. And he wanted you to be a good citizen. On and off the court. He just wanted you to do the right thing. And he set a great example for everybody. And he believed in unity. You know, he didn't believe in, you know, that one guy going off on his own as far as the team concept. He believed in team concept. And so that's why he was the guy that I really looked up to, because he had all the tangible things in place as far as, you know, coaching, administering, you know, young people. He had all those tangibles together.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Coach Bob Wade, the legendary basketball coach out of Baltimore City, Dunbar High School, to be exact. And, Coach, when I first came over to Baltimore, I noticed it was something different. Not to take anything away from some of the other schools and the Alumni Association, but there was something different about Dunbar, the Dunbar Poets and the pride. Can you talk a little bit about Dunbar pride?
It's sort of hard to describe. See, Dunbar is located right in the heart of the a public housing complex at the time, you know, surrounded by the Lafayette projects, Somerset, Latrobe, and a lot of the kids who frequent Dunbar, who attended Dunbar, you know, lived in the projects, and it was a very close knit community. So they knew one another. The families knew one another, and Dunbar was the gathering place. The high school was the gathering place, especially an athletic event. Where the community would come out and support their loved ones and the community kids. So it was a very close knit community, and it still is. And that pride that you talk about, that you describe, it was developed. It was that East Baltimore pride. You know, when you come to play Dunbar, you know, you're not playing the 10 or 12 guys on the team. You're playing that whole community. They really followed the team and supported the team, whether, you know, be basketball, baseball, football. The football games were sellouts. So it was a lot of pride, and it was developed way back in the early 50s, and, you know, carried through to the 60s. And of course, you know, we talk about Clee Brister. You know, Brister played over at Douglas High School, and he had some problems when he came over to play Dunbar.
well, you know, Cleve could hold his own both on the field, on the court, and off the court as well.
Just I know.
A great, great guy. Coach, it's probably a little known fact outside of Baltimore. The people inside of Baltimore are certainly aware of your football prowess, but outside, most people aren't aware that you were one heck of a football player in high school. And you go to Morgan State to play for another legendary coach, Papa Bear, Earl Banks. Now, here's my first question. If Bob Wade was coming out of high school today, 2019, 2020, you probably would have gone to maybe College Park or Penn State or Pitt versus Morgan because of the opportunities. Fair statement?
That's a fair statement. You know, I came along in a time where the black athlete, there are very few black athletes, you know, moving on to upper Division I schools like a Penn State and Alabama, so to speak. That's why the CIAA and the SWAC, those predominantly African American conferences, they were so strong because the opportunity was not there for the black athlete, you know, playing or going and play at a major university. And I'm grateful that the opportunity presented itself for me to go to Morgan and play under Coach Banks. I played with some very talented and gifted individuals, you know, Willie Lanier, Frenchie Fuqua, George Knock, Harvey Palmore, Raymond Chester, just to name a few. They were great athletes, and we got a great education. We were very close-knit group. We graduated. I want to emphasize that. We graduated. And we were able to find our niche in society once our playing days were over. We had something to fall back on.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to throw a name in, a guy who was my mentor, Earl Mayo. Was the running back, correct?
Earl Mayo, a good friend of mine. We stay in contact. I think I talked to him about a week ago. Came over to Morgan from Eastern High School.
Yeah.
And Spingarn High School. And he was an outstanding running back. He came together. We were freshmen together, and Earl played behind Leroy Kelly, who went on to play for years with the Cleveland Browns. Earl was a very strong running back, and he did great things at Morgan, great things.
And I'm just listening
to go on and play in the National Football League.
Coach, I'm just listening to some of the names that you're reeling off. You're talking about, you know, a Bob Wade, a Raymond Chester, a George Knock, you know, people like that playing at Morgan. And so my next question is, Coach, we talk about integration. I say integration killed HBCU sports.
Yes, it did.
Now, on one hand, you can say it's a good thing because, you know, you have the opportunity to go where you would choose to go. But on the other hand, it killed HBCU sports.
Yes, it did. Those same student athletes that we talked about, you know, they did not have the opportunity to go to those major schools back then. And integration really hurt the African American schools, the historically black schools. It really hurt. And when those kids were recruited by the Bear Bryants and the Joe Paternos of the world, it really crippled ACBC historical black colleges. It really did.
Absolutely. As we continue our conversation in the Coach's Corner with the iconic, legendary Coach Bob Wade, and Coach, talk about some of the classic, epic matchups against other great HBCU programs in the 60s, the Gramblings, the Florida A&Ms, et cetera, and some of the other future NFL players that you went head-to-head against.
Well, let me start not just jumping out of the CIAA. Let me just start with the CIAA. Maryland Eastern Shore, you know, we called it Maryland State at the time. they had a fantastic athletic program, especially football program. You know, likes of you know, playing against Emerson Boozer, for example. I mean, I have a scar on my leg now from Boozer, just running over me. he was a very very aggressive, hard nosed runner. Maryland State had outstanding athletes, student athletes, Christie, to name some. They were very, very talented. Bob Taylor. They were very, very good athletes. And then, of course, yes, we played against Florida A&M under the tutelage of Jay Gaither. He was like a saint down at Florida A&M. We played against Bob Hayes and group when Hayes was still at Florida A&M.
They Coach,
were very,
stop it right
very
there.
Good contest.
Coach, just hold it right there. How do you guard, or as we used to say, check, someone that's running a 9-100, not a 40, but a 9-100? How do you match up against someone like that, Coach?
Well, you know, Coach Banks would tell us to play, and we did this. We covered him the same way when I was fortunate enough to play professional football. Mm-hmm. You try to cover a guy like Bob Hayes inside out. You get, you know, the quarterback would play him strong to the outside, and you get help from the weak safety or the strong safety, and you know, he would play him aggressively inside for all inside moves, and then you get help from the from that linebacker dropping back with a good drop to help with the curls and so forth. But individually, it's very, very difficult to play him one-on-one, you know, man-on-man. It's very difficult because he was strong. He had a great stride. You know, his gait was extremely strong and wide. So it's very difficult. So that's how we would try to play him. I played him that way on a collegiate level. And, of course, when I was fortunate enough to play him on a professional level, we played him similar, you know, inside out.
Well, for somebody like that, Coach, my game plan would have been to steal his car keys so he couldn't get to the stadium.
But Dallas was – Coach Landry was very crafty. He would – that's when Dallas would start running those what they call – now they call them bubble screens. You know, they the quick screens with the linemen come out and block.
Right.
And
right.
Hayes would catch it and get up in the crease and get good mileage and yardage from that.
Mm-hmm. And Coach, you were relatively big for a cornerback back in the day. What are you, about 6'2", 6'3", and then at that time?
I was 6'3", at that time I played between 205 and 215. That was the time when the National Football League was moving towards bigger defensive backs. And I think it started when the Kansas City Chiefs destroyed in the Super Bowl when they played Green Bay,
Minnesota,
in the Super Bowl, and the Kansas City Chiefs big receivers ran over top of the smaller defensive backs, and mm-hmm. and after that the league started looking at larger or bigger defensive backs to try to combat, you know, to go against the stronger and taller wide receivers.
Mm-hmm. Coach, going back to the black college football in the 50s and 60s, the thing that I love, the head coaches were bigger than life. I mean, they were the main attraction. You know, you had the aforementioned Jay Gaither down in Florida. You had Earl Papa Banks in Baltimore. And then, of course, the legend of them all, the great Eddie Robinson. I mean, talk about not just the quality of the play, as we've been discussing, but just the pageantry of the games. It wasn't just a sporting event. It was a happening at a HBCU football game in the fall.
It really was. I was not fortunate enough to play against Grambling. Morgan started the Grambling Morgan series after I left, after I graduated. But, you know, Coach Banks was, he was an outstanding, he's an outstanding individual, but an outstanding coach. I'm getting kind of a little tongue-tied because it's hard to describe Coach Banks. He was a mentor. He believed in family. He believed in unity. He's just an outstanding individual, and I have the utmost respect for him. Of all the coaches I've been fortunate enough to play for on a professional level and the collegiate level, Coach Banks is right there. He's one of the tops.
Yeah.
I really loved Coach Banks, not just as a football coach, but as an individual. He's just a super guy. He gave me an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Gave me an opportunity, and he also cared about me off the field. That's the big thing. He really did.
And I want to piggyback on something that you said earlier, because this is so important. You had great student athletes, but as you stated, you guys graduated. You just didn't leave, play 3 or 4 years, and then that was it. You got your degrees. And that nurturing that the athletes received out of Morgan, out of FAMU, out of Howard, et cetera, man, you know what? It was invaluable, correct?
Yes, correct. See, the professors, they cared about you. They gave you that extra time. They would take the time to work with you after class. And you know, and they cared about you as an individual, not just as a number in a class, or the last few digits of your Social Security number. They cared about you as an individual.
Yeah.
They really would take the extra time to work with you, and you know, if you're having difficulty. And Coach Banks, for example, was the kind of coach that would give you a little leeway if you were having a problem. He would give you the leeway to miss a practice to work on stretching yourself in the classroom, or meet with a professor. He would give you that opportunity because he believed that he wanted his kids to graduate. You know, not just play, but to graduate, and that's what he did.
Yeah. And now you make it to the highest level of football, the NFL. Talk about that transition, and what was that like, Coach?
Well, at that the time that I was drafted, you know, I was not a high draft choice. That's when the National Football League, they had like 17 rounds, and I was drafted on the 15th round by the then Baltimore Colts. You know, there was no fancy fanfare like they have now. I found out I was drafted. I was watching the local news over here in Baltimore, and the local sportscaster Vince Bagley on our local station over here, Channel 11. He mentioned. Oh, and by the way, the coach just drafted Bob Wade from Morgan State University, and that's how I found out. And then, of course, I got the call later on that next morning. But moving into the National Football League was an eye-opening experience. It was guys were much – they were bigger, they were faster, and it was a true, true business. You know, you specialize in your craft. You try to do the best you could as far as learning the playbook and improving your craft to try to make that squad. So it was an eye-opening experience for me, moving from the collegiate level to the professional level. Very difficult.
Who were some of the older guys, so to speak, the veterans at camp that mentored you, that took you under their wings and showed you the ropes, so to speak?
Well, when I was drafted by the Baltimore Colts, we practiced up at Westminster College up in Western Maryland. The guy who was my idol, who I had pictures of on my wall in my room growing up, was Lenny Moore. And so when I was fortunate enough to be drafted by the Colts, and I was assigned a number. My number was 23, and Lenny Moore's number was 24. So numerical, they put you know, your locker numerically in a locker room. They assigned your locker, and I'm sitting next to Lenny Moore, and that was my idol, you know. And so we're sitting there, and we just finished the first practice with the veterans, and he, you know, remember that he wore the high tops, and he. Mm-hmm. He would have the tape taped around his, they call it spats.
Spats, that's right.
And spats. And he took his tape off, and he dropped the tape on the floor. And to this day, Butch, I told Lenny, I have the piece, that tape that he unwrapped off of, you know, from his shoe. I still have that tape. Because he was my idol. He was my idol growing up.
Yeah.
And but yeah, it was Lenny Moore. Jim Parker, Lenny Lyles, you know, Raymond Burr. I had to cover Raymond Burr every day in practice.
Oh,
Raymond
my goodness.
Jimmy Orr, Tom Natty. I mean, those were just some of the guys. And then on defense, it was, and, you know, Bubba Smith and I, we came in the same year. It was Bubba Smith, Charlie Stooks from Maryland Eastern Shore.
Yeah.
We all came in, Preston Pearson, we all came in together.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an eye-opening experience. But, yeah, but Lenny Moore was my idol, and I had an opportunity to be assigned my locker next to him. Unbelievable.
Mine as well. As we continue our conversation in the locker room, it is Bob Wade. And, Coach, you talked about Sugar Cane in high school, Earl Banks in college, and now you, I tell you, man, you've been blessed. You play under another iconic coach, arguably the coach of coaches for 1 year, Vince Lombardi. Talk about Lombardi.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to come to the Redskins. I was in Pittsburgh playing with the Steelers, and I started for the Steelers. At left cornerback. I was on the left side. Mark Woodson was the right cornerback. Paul Martha was the strong safety, and Clinton Thomas was the other safety. And got into a little contract dispute. I thought I had a good year, and I wanted a raise. I wanted more money on my, you know, because I had a great year. And so we got in a contract dispute, and Mr. Rooney said, you know, either you take it or leave it. And I said, I called Coach Banks, who was my agent at the time, and Coach said, no, you deserve more. And he tried to talk to Mr. Rooney. He didn't want to hear it. So they traded me to the Redskins. And that's when I first met Mr. Coach Lombardi. I come in, and he said, I understand you had a little contract dispute. This is what we're going to give you. Is that okay? I said, yes, sir, that's fine. He said, change your clothes, go, and let's go practice. He was you're talking about a no-nonsense person. He was no-nonsense. He was, you know, it was his way or the highway. And he was very simplistic. He believed in doing things as simple as possible. You know, he could care less. You could know where he's coming. You just block it. Mm-hmm. You know. And it was just an honor for me to have an opportunity to play for Coach Lombardi for that year when I was with the Redskins. And I was in the backfield with it was Pat Fisher,
mm-hmm.
Ricky Harris, Mike Bass. Teddy Factor. That was the group, and of course Chris Hamburger was the
linebacker.
Was that linebacker? And, you know, it was a good group. Jurgensen was the quarterback.
Talk about Sonny Jurgensen, because some of the younger fans, football fans, and, you know, they know about, of course, Tom Brady and Drew Brees and people like that. But I tell them that in terms of just pure passing, no quarterback threw a prettier ball and a tighter spiral than the redhead Sonny Jurgensen.
He was very talented. You know, to look at him, you would think he didn't have that athletic that arm. Mm-hmm. But he could really throw the football, and he was, mm-hmm. and he could really put it in, in tight mm-hmm. windows. He could really. He was not very mobile, but he was.
No.
He could really throw the football, and to me, he was a good leader. He was an outstanding leader. And I think he was the one that caught on that Larry Brown was having difficulty hearing the plays in the huddle.
And they
repositioned Larry in the huddle, and of course put the hearing aid in his helmet. But Jurgensen picked that up.
And you know, Coach, unfortunately, Vince Lombardi just stayed 1 year. He died of cancer. But just playing that what-if game, I'm almost certain that if Lombardi had not died, that within the next two seasons, as happened, but not only with Washington had gotten to the Super Bowl as they did under George Allen, but they would have won under Lombardi.
He was I feel the same way, Butch, because he was getting all of his – Those certain players, you know, he was putting them in place prior to his passing, and of course his coaching staff. He had a very good coaching staff in place, and I feel the same way that he was going to. The Redskins were going to be very, 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 very a good team down the road. They were going to be very, very good.
Yeah,
Larry Brown was there, and Sonny was throwing a ball to what's this?
Charlie Taylor,
and had Smith as a tight end.
Yeah.
He was a wide receiver. He could really catch, and they had got the kid long from Green Bay, the wide receiver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Haraway, they got picked up Haraway from
Charlie Haraway, good
Browns.
Blocking
yeah.
back. Yeah. Yeah.
yeah.
Very
Dave
good.
Copay, it was a good group. It was a good group that he had to assemble.
And Coach, you mentioned Dave Copay, Jerry Smith. The one thing that the guys who I know personally, such as yourself and Fane Musgrove, Larry Brown, they talk about Lombardi. Yeah, he was a taskmaster. He was a disciplinarian. But he was a man's man. And he didn't care about your race or your sexuality.
Exactly.
If
right.
you were a football player, that's all he cared about.
That's true. He believed in your faith, your family, mm-hmm. faith, family, and team. That was his motto. Every Saturday he would, you know, Saturday was like walkthrough. He would allow you to bring your kids, and he just believed in family. Mm-hmm. Whenever we traveled, he'd always travel with the priest and his wife. They were right there with him. But he was quite a guy.
Yeah.
A lot of respect for him. A lot mm-hmm. of respect.
Well, Coach, now let's pivot from your NFL football career. You decide to give back. You decide now it's time for you to be a Sugar Cane, Earl Banks, a Vince Lombardi. You come back. You are an educator and a coach. At what point did you decide that I want to be a coach and a leader of student athletes?
Well, when I finished with the Denver Broncos, and And when I came back home, I had a degree, and I applied for a teaching position, and I got a teaching position at Edmondson High School here in Baltimore, Edmondson High School, which is on the west side of Baltimore City. And when I got there, I was a physical education teacher. And when I got there, one of the physical educators was out sick, so I assumed his teaching position. And the athletic director approached me and said, "Hey, would you mind filling in and coach the JV baseball team?" So I didn't have a problem. I said, "Sure." I played baseball, grew up playing baseball. So I had good success. And then the football coach was a guy named Charlie Robinson. Charlie Robinson asked me would I mind, you know, helping with the football team. And I would go out and work with the defensive backs and linebackers and so forth. And that's how it really started. And then I worked with Edmondson, and then I got an opportunity to coach the JV basketball team at Edmondson, and the varsity coach left and went to Ohio, and the athletic director asked me would I mind moving up and coaching the varsity team, and I did that, and that's how I got started with in high school basketball. You know, I coached the varsity team. And the high school coach, the varsity coach left the year after Marvin Webster left. Marvin Webster was a senior, and while I was coaching the JV basketball team, he was a senior on the varsity team. So when I got the varsity job, Marvin had just graduated, and the guy who I coached at Emerson was Ed Hopkins, who played at Georgetown. Yeah.
That's right.
Ed Hopkins. So I had success. And then, of course, I got the opportunity to go back to my alma mater, to Dunbar High School. I was offered the position at Dunbar, not just as a basketball coach, but the athletic director and department head of physical education, replacing my former coach, Bill Sugarcane.
Yeah.
And so that's how I got started.
And coach, it's nothing like, I mean, to coaching is such a privilege. It is not a right, it's a privilege. To have the title coach is so powerful. But to add the icing on the cake, so to speak, to go back to your school, your alma mater, and coach and teach, man, it's nothing like it. Coach, talk about, again, doing this interview, you put great emphasis, rightly so, on your mentors at the various levels, Coach Kane, Coach Banks, Lombardi. Now, you as a coach, known as a disciplinarian, talk about how important discipline is, because I was first taught by my mentors that no learning can take place, be it the classroom or the gymnasium, without discipline first.
Well, that's correct. And that, to me, the gymnasium was my classroom, and that's how I conveyed it to my student athletes that they were coming. There was another class, and I wanted nothing but the utmost their attention and their respect. And if you couldn't adhere to my rules, you just had to go. You couldn't play. Just like the teacher, if you were disruptive in the classroom, the teacher would ask you to be removed or call down to the office and have someone come up to remove you. I did the same thing as far as the gymnasium was concerned. But that was my philosophy. I felt that no learning could take place if there was not discipline. So if kids cutting up, and not paying attention, it's gonna hurt the team down the road, especially when it, you know, the tight ball game when everybody needs to be clicking on the same cylinder, we could hurt the team. So, yes, I was a stern disciplinarian. You had to follow the rules.
Coach, my favorite Bob Wade story, and I'll share with our listeners. I was told this by a very prominent Baltimore politician who was a student at Dunbar at the time. And he and one of his buddies were cutting up class, missing class, cutting class. Coach Bob Wade caught him and said, okay, after school, I want you to meet me in the gymnasium. After school, you had them washing the floors, picking up trash, emptying the trash. And it wasn't because you wanted to show them how much of a tough person you were. You wanted to teach them a lesson. And after they did their chores, you brought them in and said, now, if you don't go to school, if you don't attend class, what you just did for 2 hours, you could be doing that all of your life without an education. They got the message, Coach. But you can't do that now, can you?
No, they might rule that as child abuse. They might rule that as being child abuse, that you were, you know, being too hard on the student. And, of course, you might get a lot of flack from today's parent. You know, where how dare you make my child, you know, pick this trash up or do this or do that. So, you know, no, you couldn't do it today. Not today.
Mm-hmm. No, you couldn't. All right, Coach. And then, man, you build a powerhouse in the tradition that Sugar Cane was proud of you. Talk about the early 80 teams, especially the 82 and the 83 teams. How did you develop such a talented team? But this is what I give you the credit for. I mean, obviously, if you want to make good chicken salad, you got to have good chicken. But sometimes you can have the good chicken and you can overcook it, you can undercook it, you can burn it up.
That's true, but yeah, we were very fortunate. The 82 team, was very talented, and it, you know, you had a guy like Wingate, Muggsy Bogues, Reggie Williams, Tim Dawson. You know, they were very Gary Graham. You know, Graham goes off to, he finishes and goes to Vegas, plays under Todd Canyon, one of the top defensive players, on the collegiate players. Gary Graham was the younger brother of Ernest Graham.
Yeah.
Then of course Muggsy, you know, he was phenomenal, and Wingate, just a great first-step slasher, went on to play over at Georgetown under Coach Thompson, and, of course, Reggie Williams. Just great athletes. And then, of course, we had Tim Dawson, who played at GW for a year under Gimbelstoff before leaving there and going to the University of Miami. He finished his career at the University of Miami. But we had a great supporting cast, too. You know, Herman Harita went on to Syracuse, and Keith James played at South Carolina. You know, we had a great supporting cast also. So it was just a very good team, very good team.
Well,
they were very
always,
unselfish.
Coach, I always gave you credit because, again, you had talent. You were able to mold all of those talented guys who were used to being the stars of their rec team or their junior high school team, and you molded them into a role-developed team. And that's coaching, man. That's coaching.
Well, they were very good kids. They listened. They wanted to. They all had that desire to do well and move. Hopefully, be fortunate enough to move to the next level as far as they are after their career.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just a pleasure to be around. But even but the guys before them set the tone. You know, like Ernest Graham coming into the program in 1976, 77. Ernest coming over, and then we had an opportunity to play against West Philly.
Yeah,
West Philly came down. They played a big game at the Civic Arena in Baltimore. West Philly had Gene Banks and Turkey Tillman, and just a great atmosphere for high school basketball. And a lot of the kids, you know, they wanted to be part of that.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to be part of that. So we were very fortunate, very fortunate.
Bob Wade is in the Coach's Corner with Coach Butch McAdams, in and out of sports. And, Coach, we've got about 15 minutes left, but we're going to cover some more ground. Just briefly talk about some of the things. And I had the privilege and the blessing to coach in the 70s and 80s, early 90s myself. And if you're coaching in an inner city, be it Baltimore, D.C., Philadelphia, New York, during that time, it wasn't just basketball. It wasn't just X's and O's in sport. You had to be a protector of your players because of that crack epidemic. Talk about how you protected your players from the streets.
Well, I did the best I could. You know, you had what I call the agents. The agents would try to gravitate to them, to win them over, you know, giving them a dollar here, a dollar there, or buying them this, and you just had to, you know, stay on top of things. And we would practice late in the evening after we had a mandatory study hall before we practiced. I had to.
Mm-hmm.
Instructors, you know, come down and work with the kids after school in study hall, and then after study hall, then we would practice. And when practice was over, you know, those kids who did not live in the projects, who lived, for example, Wingate, lived a few miles away. We would I'd send them home in cabs, so they wouldn't have to be walking the streets and, you know, bumping into the what I call
sure.
the agents, those
yeah.
guys trying to win favors. We'd have the cabs lined up outside, and they'd get in cabs, and cab driver would, you know, take them home.
Wow.
I did not allow
yeah.
them to walk the streets, to go home.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I just kept an eye on them, and then, of course, the community would help you also. If they saw certain things, they would call me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say that, you know, John Doe is you know, hanging around certain people it shouldn't be. And I would approach him along with the parent. I would communicate with the parent.
Well,
and we'd,
rumor,
you know, work,
rumor.
I try to work hard hand-in-hand with the parent.
Coach, rumor has it that you had the best private security person that money could buy, and our mutual great friend Toby Marshall Goodwin. So, you know,
yeah,
that
was
better than having Wide Earp with you.
I'm telling you. Yep.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
You know, excuse me, Coach. Real quick, were you surprised? Probably not. But were you surprised at the success that Muggsy Bogues had at Wake Forest, but then especially in the NBA, little 5'3", 5'4", Muggsy Bogues, but he was the man.
He made a believe out of me when he played his first high school game. He played and he held his own against you know, one of the top guards in our area. He held his own, and he was able to make the large or the bigger guys fearful of him, because the average big man gets the ball, gets the rebound, and what do they want to do? They bring it down.
Put it down.
And it was
Muggsy. Right.
And it was Muggsy. And but he really opened my eyes his first high school game. And of course, he was fortunate enough to be recruited by Wake Forest. I talked to Carl Tacy, who just passed recently.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to Carl Tacy and said, "Look, if you're not going to play him, don't use him as a novelty now. Just if you're not going to play him, let him go somewhere where he's going to play." He said, "No, coach." He and Ernie Nesta
mm-hmm.
was the assistant coach. Ernie said, "No, coach. We promise you, we're not. He's going to play. He's going to play," and he. And he set the ACC on fire. He really did.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Coach, we got about 8 minutes left, 9 minutes. But, I mean, come on, 10 years. Listen to this record, folks. Coach Wade is humble. But I got to tell it. 10 years at Dunbar, 341 victories to just 25 defeats. Unbelievable. And then, Coach, you become Jackie Robinson, so to speak. You become the first African-American head coach in the ACC. You go to College Park. Now, that's a little sore part with me. Coach, let me make this statement, and you tell me whether it's a fair statement or not. And you've always been candid and upfront. Bob Wade certainly was qualified and could have been a Hall of Fame coach if given the opportunity. But your problem would have been my problem in that the NCAA rules were so outdated that you and I and other caring coaches were used to helping players, and you couldn't do that. And if you did it, they're crying foul. Is that a fair statement, Coach?
Yeah, that's a fair statement. What you're alluding to is one of our players had to take a course at Prince George Community College. It was a cold night. I mean, he was out there on Route 1. He and a football player. They were trying to get a ride to go down to PG Community College. And they had missed their ride. They were trying to get there. And the assistant coach, not Bob Wade, the assistant coach saw them standing out there on that cold night, and asked them where they were going. And they said, "We're going to go to class at PG Community College." He gave them a ride to PG Community College. And of course, it got back that to the administration that we had given them an unfair advantage of, you know, letting a scholarship player giving them unfair advantages of commuting them to class. The football player was not punished, but the basketball player was.
Yeah, that's still a very sore spot with me. Because, look, you come into a program that was in shambles. The very next year, you get them in the tournament. And then they give you one more year, and that's it. All right? And then after that, my second beef is you go home, and why didn't Morgan hire Bob Wade? And you could have led them to a championship. You know, not just a MEAC, but in the big dance. There's no question you would have done it. I'm sorry,
well,
Coach. Go ahead.
I know. Well, rumor has it. Well, the deal was there. It was, you know, I was. It was with the handshake, and the deal was there. But rumor has it that a very strong politician threatened the. Threatened the President Morgan, you know, saying that if you bring Bob Wade into your program, then you're not going to get those dollars from Annapolis that you need.
Oh my goodness!
So the president had to back off. Same thing happened at Maryland Eastern Shore. Dr. Heitch,
yeah,
was given the same type of ultimatum. So it was almost like a black ball, but life goes on. Life goes on.
That's unfortunate. And Coach, but the story doesn't end there. We've got about 3 minutes, but let's talk about the great work that you did as a city administrator under sports and physical education, et cetera. And currently, that wonderful, folks, if you don't know about it, hey, the Basketball Academy that Bob Wade and Dr. Heyman and others put on every year. Let's spend the last 2.5 minutes or so talking about the Basketball Academy.
Yeah, which I was fortunate enough to come back into Baltimore, going back into the school system, and again, had my degree and so forth. And I was assumed the position of supervisor of athletics for Baltimore City Public Schools. Had the great fortune to work with a guy like Earl Hawkins over at PG County.
Yeah.
And so forth, and other athletic administrators from around the state of Maryland. But we came up with the idea of this, what we call the Basketball Academy. This is our 25th year doing it, where we bring in 14 male teams and 6 female teams from around the Baltimore, D.C. metropolitan area, and also teams from outside of the area, Philadelphia, New York, what have you. And we do what we call we have a workshop. We have workshops, you know, where it's dealing with conflict resolution, SAT, financial, you know, how to handle finance. And then we do the workshops during the day on the campus of Morgan State University.
Sure.
Give them a college experience. And then they have, you know, they go to lunch right on the campus. Then at lunch, we take them to different areas of the city. They interact with senior citizens. We introduce them to the seniors. They sit down with the seniors. They read for the seniors. They walk with the seniors. Then we take them to the Great Blacks and Wags, different cultural events and
sure.
areas in Baltimore. And then, of course, in the afternoon, they play. They compete against one another. It's not
Absolutely.
It's not who wins, who loses.
No.
It's just friendly competition. And we've been doing it for 25 years. We've had over 1,500 kids to move on, and several of them have moved
sure.
on to the collegiate level. And I can remember one player at Georgetown, was it Braswell? He was having difficulty.
Yes.
Came to the academy, got his SAT scores up. Doctor with Mr. Swan, who I know folks over in the D.C. area are familiar with John Swan.
Oh,
John Swan is one of the ones that helped us and worked with our kids and got them eligible to accept those scholarships. We're going to our 25th year.
Fantastic, Coach. Coach, this has been a great interview. Our lines were packed. People are texting me saying, I'm trying to get through. I told them, you know, Bob Wade always sells out. And, Coach, this is the first time I didn't ask you the question.
I know
73 Dunbar versus 83 Dunbar. I didn't ask the Coach, but thank you so much, man.
And I keep telling you, I know Timmy Green is listening, and I'm not
right.
saying anything
okay.
about that team. Skip Wild's team, no.
All right. Thanks, Coach. All
My
right,
pleasure,
folks. And that was the legendary Coach Bob Wade. Hope you enjoyed it. Join us on Thursday when we'll have Kurt Trouble Smith in the Coach's Corner. Boy, but I want to thank our sponsors, Horton's Funeral Services, Dr. Edward T. Buford, and the Athletic Republic Capital Region, and especially a big thanks to the AfricanAmericanAthlete.com and my producer, my